Take me where the promises are real.
Hey y'all, let's have a meeting. My name is Amy and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Boy Chub speaker meeting at the NIBA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Thanks everybody. I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. The last little part here, I'm introducing the speaker. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us will be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. And our speaker tonight, this is significant to me, it was very significant at the time, I've never told Marjorie, but I picked up my white chip at the Gwinnett Room January 7th, 2003, and she was going to, I don't know that she was there that day, but she was a regular at the Gwinnett Room. And I could remember listening to her share, because I listened to everybody then, I was so desperate. And she had almost 5 years, or she just got 5 years, which was Bill Wilson to me. You know, how in the world could anybody do that? And then I had an account at a financial institution. And one day I was in there, and I saw her in there. And that's the first time I ever saw anybody in a meeting in a public place. That may not make any sense to you, but there's something about it. I say, wow, they actually go out from the rooms and live lives, you know, somewhere else. And I've always looked forward to seeing her. I've been going back to the Gwinnett Room a little more the last few months, and I've been fortunate to have a lot of them coming down to tell their story. And there's no one I'd rather be here tonight to tell their story than Marjorie. You know you're at home here, Marjorie, so please welcome her with me.
Hi everyone, I'm Marjorie. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. I brought two big books. This big book here, I found this at one of the sales for Grapevine, and it's a book that has all 1 through 6 up to Dr. Bob's story. And I really like it because it's really thin. I'm giving a shout out. And then this one has the stories in it, and I wanted to read something from the stories. Again, I'm Marjorie. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 3rd, 1998. I have 20 years of sobriety by the grace of God, and I know it's only by His grace today that I have that. But I only really have one day, and that day is today. And I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor women. And I have a home group. Actually, I have two home groups. I do a lot of service in one of them. It's a 9 o'clock meeting on Saturday mornings at the Gwinnett Room. Come out and see us if you'd like. It starts at 9. It's called the 9. And then I belong to a group. It's called the Fourth Dimension. It is in Lawrenceville also on Thursday nights at 6:15, an open meeting. Did I get everything? Okay. What I wanted to start to do is, this is, you know, I'm up here to tell you, let me find my page here. You know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm going to start by reading something out of the big book. It's on page 73 of the big book, and this describes me, I think, from the time that I was probably 3 or 4 years old. It says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension that makes for more drinking. And that was the way that I felt from the time I think that I could even know that I was alive. It became worse when I started drinking, but I never felt a part of. I'll begin my story with, I grew up in Orlando, Florida. My real parents were alcoholic and a drug addict. I have a biological brother and sister. And the life, you know, it was an alcoholic and addict life as far as that goes. And they would go out and, you know, drink and drug, and they would lock us up in a room and put a little coffee can in there so we'd go to the bathroom in there. And they would be gone all night. And then they would come back in the morning and let us out. And the neighbors got a hold of this. This went on for quite a while. And the neighbors started noticing that something was wrong. And they called the state. The state came in and they decided that we were going to be taken from my parents. I'm not real good with dates and times and things like that. You know, I learned to bottle up a lot and just move on. And my life was just one step after the other to survive. So they came in, they took my brother and sister. My sister's the oldest, my brother's the middle, and I was the baby. And they took us to my grandmother, who at that time was pretty, you know, she was up in her years. She never had, you know, in a long time had any kids present. She wasn't really present in our life, but she was the next one that they decided that instead of putting us into foster care, that they would try that. We went to my grandmother, and I have to say the label that we carried around was that we were baggage. We came with a lot of baggage, and we did. You know, when you're in that kind of a lifestyle and there's a lot of chaos and drama and abuse going on, I think that the kids pick up on that. And so she reported back to DFACS that we were too much to handle. And apparently one day they didn't do much, and one day she just decided that she would pen a note on us all and put us on the church of a Methodist church. And she had our names on each one of us, and we were left on the church steps. And at that time, that's the last remembrance of my grandmother that I had, was her walking away. And that's when we were on an orphanage. I guess it was the Methodist orphanage that we ended up going into. It was also not long after that, it was also the last time that I saw my sister and my brother for a long time. And they took each of us individually and placed us in foster care. And all I knew at that time is, I just remember, you know, we talk about God in here a lot, and I just remember that I used to pray to something, you know, just to give me a mom and a dad. I wanted a mom and a dad. And I would bargain with God, and I would try to be the best little girl that I could be. And I thought I would do everything as perfectly as I could do it so that I could have that mom and dad. And it didn't work for a long time. Well, I'm going to say it never worked, but I did end up getting adopted. So we went to different homes, and I lost contact with my brother and sister. And there was a lot for me. There was a lot of abuse. There was physical, mental, emotional abuse. and in each foster home. And I remember that I had a guardian that kind of like would check on us, and I would try to tell her that things were going on that shouldn't be going on. And I think I was about 4 at that age, and I'd beg her to not leave me there, but she didn't believe me. And she just said, you know, I had a lot of problems and I was thinking it. And so I remember that wherever I went, I had a suitcase. I had this little suitcase that I would pack whatever I had in that suitcase. And I kept that for a very long time. And I kept it under the bed because I knew, I just knew I wasn't going to stay at that home very long. And I didn't give that suitcase up until it had been in the trunk of my car until I had 13 or 15 years in this program, because I never felt that anywhere I went I was going to be there very long. But I had to finally give it up. That was really hard. But anyway, I kept that, and they would report me, and they would say that I had too much baggage, I was hard to handle, and that they couldn't handle me, and so off we would go to another home. And I never understood that, because I really didn't think I caused any problem. I did have emotional problems, I cried a lot, I was scared of everything, I was full of fear, I was full of terror. Where they talk about that in the big book, you know, the four horsemen. Every day I woke up with them. Fear, terror, frightened, and despair, I believe they are. And I woke up with them every day not knowing what was going to happen. I had to become an adult really quick, because to me I had to take on adult things in order to find a way to live my life, you know, because I had no guidance or direction. I was just there, and I felt the presence of just being there. There was no love, there was no hugs, there was no emotional or any kind of security there. And so I ended up like just, like I said, you know, anything that I felt, I began to believe that I tell somebody what I felt, they wouldn't believe me. It was like I didn't have a voice. They couldn't hear me. And I would talk louder and louder and louder so maybe they could hear me. And then I would get in trouble for that, you know. So I quieted down a little bit and I began to stuff everything. And then we would have... You know, it was like every weekend or every other weekend, we'd go back to the orphanage, and that's where my prayers became heavier and heavier the next day before I knew we were going to go, because that's where the people would come in. This is where I learned to be a little bit like the paragraph that I read. It's where I began to be something that I really wasn't, because I would put on a new pair of shoes that they had for me, little lace ruffled socks and a nice little dress, and children are meant to be seen, not heard. And we would stand in this line, and that's when I got to see my brother and sister for a very short period of time, but they were over there and I was here. And we would be in this line, and that's when people would come in and kind of like look at you to see if they wanted to take you home. And so I learned to put on this happy smile. You know, mind you, I'm 4 and 5, about 5 years old, and I would just be going, God, please give me a mom and dad. You know, please, please. And then they would go by, and it wouldn't happen. And then I'd go back to a home, and then it continued on like that. And there was one time we were there, and they put my sister, my brother, and myself together. And I was like, wow, there's something different. And this couple came in, and they walked by us, and they looked us up and down, and they would say, like, say, I don't know, hi or something, to see how we responded to them. And at that time, I just remember, I've been thinking about it. I don't think I was able to respond too much, but it didn't matter, because their focus was on my brother. And so I could tell that, because all the attention was being given there. This is also where I think that I began to learn that I need to do something to get attention, whatever it is. That's where I learned to manipulate. I believe it's where I learned to lie. I believe it's where I learned to do a lot of the defects that got more, you know, worse and worse inside of me. And so I put on a smile, you know, when inside I was dying on the inside. And so the lady, she said, well, we would like my brother. And I was just like, okay. Well, it came out to be that if we were ever to be adopted, that we were being adopted together, which didn't make a whole lot of sense to me and never has, as a fact that during those first 5 years, it's very crucial in order to have that security and those, and to have your people together and to learn about them. And that's the most crucial part of your childhood, is 1 through 5. And I didn't have a relationship with my brother and sister. So they continued to say, can we just not get the one? And we heard this. You know, I was so angry about that, even though I'm like 5. I didn't know it was anger. But, you know, when I got into the program, and it was quite many years after that, I was angry about the fact that they would allow, at the institution, that they would allow things like that to be said in front of children. I held that for a very long time in my drinking and in my resentments. You know, to have other children here that they're not wanted, but the one is. And it gave me a lot of jealousy and a lot of envy and things like that for my brother. The bottom line is, we did get adopted. And I stand up here today, even though that the forgiveness has happened, I've done my ninth step. I stand up here today and tell you there's never been a relationship with the woman. It was a living hell, and I wish that I would have stayed where I was at. But I learned to be grateful for the home that I was given and the food that I was given, and knowing that they did the best that they could do with what they had. And this was a woman of so much resentment for not being able to have her own kids. She had lost many kids trying to have them, and she had a lot of resentment. And she did not want girls. She wanted a boy. She wanted boys. She got a boy. And she told us when we got there not to even try to make it right with her. You know, so I learned that right off the bat. But I had the alcoholic mind that told me, I need more and I want more and I'm going to get more. And I tried for many, many, many years to try to get that love and attention. I started drinking. They were a Catholic Irish family. They drank a lot. They had a bar in the house. And I had my first drink when I was 15 years old, peppermint schnapps. And I drank the bottle of it, and I remember when it went down, I just remember that feeling. It took that fear and all that terror away. It was like it went down there, and it was like my shoulders came down, and I felt something I'd never felt before. And I think I said something like, thank you, God. But I don't remember exactly, but I do remember sitting and puking in the toilet for the rest of the night and passed out. That stopped me for 2 more years. That was my only drink at 15, and I went 2 more years. I turned 17 years old. I graduated from high school, and I decided that I wanted to become a nurse. I wanted to leave the house. Back up a little, my sister ran away when she was 15, and my brother left home at the age of 16 and went to Seattle. So it was me in the house, and it was me of a constant trying to please and trying to do whatever I could do for her. She had a lot of migraines, and she said these words to me that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with that I'll never forget. She would always say, when I'd be putting a rag on her head or something, she would say, you're killing me. And I thought, oh my God, I'm killing her. You know, I really believe those words. They're said enough, you begin to believe them. No, I'm sorry. You're going to be the death of me, is what she said. You're going to be the death of me. So I thought, well, I'm going to go away to college. You know, I want to get away like they did. And I didn't really have a lot of contact with my brother and sister after that until later on in life. And I said, I'm going to be a nurse. I wanted to go to the University of South Florida. And I did. I was a good student. I made it to the campus of University of South Florida. I did not become a nurse, and I never made it to the first semester. What happened was, is that, and I don't understand it, it's just been told to me, is that I got a phone call, and one of my uncles that isn't related to me, but he was the only man that never abused me sexually, and he used to take me for ice cream and stuff, and I could talk to him, and he never said I was baggage or that I was anything bad. And I got a phone call that he suddenly passed away. And when that happened, I just remember going and I got some alcohol. And I remember drinking and drinking and drinking and walking around campus. And then the next thing I know is I woke up and there was a security guard standing over me from the school campus. And then police came. And they asked me what my name was, what the date was, and who the president was. And I didn't know. I had gone into a psychotic break at that time. And they transferred me to the university campus hospital. And then from there, they transferred me to an outside hospital. And I remained there for 7 to 8 months. It took a while for me to gain back, like, through therapy and things like that. And he explained to me it was just a matter of, it's hard, you know, abandonment, being left, kids gone, my life of that, and something in my brain, that one phone call when there was somebody that was so deeply loved was gone. And something clicked in my brain, and the alcohol and that put me out, and I went into a state of non-existence, basically. And I went into the hospital, and Joan, my mother, she would not come and see me. She told me that's where I belonged. And the father that, the father's a different, his name is Al, he's a different little story because he would pay some attention to me, but it was always when she wasn't in the house. He would rock me or sit me on his lap and bounce me up and down, and I remember that, and it was fun, and I loved it. But she'd walk in the room, and he'd throw me down. So I got really, really confused about love, and I got confused about what happened. And so that was confusing, but he did come see me in the hospital, and he just said he hoped the best for me. And left and went. I was in Tampa. They were in Orlando. That went on. I left the hospital against medical advice because in that time I became pregnant. When we would have leaves, I had a boyfriend that I had snuck around in school for a very long time. Wasn't allowed to date or anything, like go out or anything in the house. We were usually very punished, and I spent a lot of time in my room, 6 to 8 weeks sometimes, where if I got a B or a C, and I'd have to stay in my room, and I wasn't a part of the family, and I did my own laundry, and they'd bring my dinner to the door, and I learned to talk to my animals as my friends. And then, so when I got to school, too, I didn't know how to act. I had no experience in life whatsoever, none. I had never been taught financially anything. So I was there, but I wanted to go away so that I thought that I could live a life. But I couldn't do it until I put a drop of alcohol in my body. Then I became somebody that I never knew or I thought I wanted to be. And it worked for a while. But it only worked to take all the terror away. It wasn't like fun, you know. It was something that took it away from me. But I left the hospital because I found out I was pregnant. I went out on leaves with him. I ended up pregnant. I got real sick. They didn't know what it was. And then they found out. And I said, okay, the perfect alcoholic thinking. I want to leave the hospital. I'm going to go to the store. I'm going to buy the wedding ring, and I'm going to call him, and then I'm going to go to the courthouse, and we're going to get married. We're going to have the baby, and we're going to have great, great life. That's what I wanted. That's really what I wanted, because I thought the baby was going to be something that I could love, and it would forever love me. And so I took it way out of, you know, out of context. But I did. I left the hospital. I made it back to Orlando. I had called him first, and he at the hospital, the nurse said, I think we better call him. I'm like, okay. He told me no. He said that he was going to get married, that he was engaged to someone. And I said, no. I said, we're having a baby, so I'll be back. I was pretty much out of my mind. You know, I had my mind set up. And so I went back, and I did what I said I did, and I went to where he worked. And I'm going to tell you, I don't know, like, what God's plan was for this, except that a lot of lessons that I've learned since, and it got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I went there, and not right at that time, but he did marry me. And he married me at the courthouse, and he had, I guess the time he needed was to set up a duplex. He had this little duplex for me, and he put me in it. I had no car, no phone, no nothing. He put me in there, and then he said that he would be back daily to give me some food. And he went with his girlfriend. So that was quite a reminder of what I had just come out of, and I knew no better. I lived in that house until he would come, and then I was excited to see him, but he never took me out of that house. And then the last day that I remember is that he asked me for a divorce. I was 7 months pregnant. He bought me this little car, like the Flintstones, because the back of it had holes in it, and the exhaust came up. But I had something to live in, because he asked me to leave the duplex. And I remember begging him. Love is not to have to beg for. But I remember begging him on my knees, please don't leave me. And it got too, and kind of a, he got tired of hearing me beg, I guess. He took a bottle of whiskey, and he hit me in the stomach. And I remember going to the hospital, and this is another part of, you know, the disease, I believe, the isms. Because at this time, I was drinking. I was pregnant. I was drinking the whole time. And I lied at the hospital. They knew something wasn't right. I lied about it, and I got him out of it. And from that point on, I'll just say this. I lived in my car. I ate out of dumpsters from behind McDonald's because they had food they threw away. That was good food. I did that, and I became the world's number one best stalker. And I followed him and her. I sat across from their little apartment, and I watched, and I prayed, and I hoped, and I continued to make bad scenes with him and her. Didn't do me any good. And I lived in there until it was time to have the baby. And in that time, I believe for me is when all of this time, I knew my life was unmanageable, you know, but it got a lot worse from that point. But why I bring that up is because at that time in that car is when I believe, even though I'd never been to AA, I believe that I took step two. And I remember asking him and asking God and praying that he could bring me back to some kind of sanity so that I could make a decision to realize that I'm living in a car, I have no food, I have no money, I have no support, I have no friends, I'm stalking people, I'm drinking, I'm probably hurting the baby, and I remember asking him to bring me to a amount of sanity where I could make a decision. And that decision was kept me drinking from the age of 18 until I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 40 years old. And that decision was, do I keep this baby or do I give the baby up for adoption? And I carried a lot of guilt and shame for the longest time in my life, which propelled me to drink and drink and almost drink myself to death because I decided to give her, it was a baby girl, to give her up for adoption because I knew that I could do nothing for her. I knew I couldn't give her a good life. But I also had in the back of my mind all the time is, what if she gets in a home like I was in? So it was really, really difficult. And I made that decision. I had a taxi take me to the hospital. And from that point, I really don't remember a whole lot. You know, back then they put you out. You don't see the baby. The only thing I remember is I went through the Catholic Social Services and I told them that I had one request or I would not sign the papers. And that request, maybe it was not good, but it's what I wanted. And for once, somebody listened to me. And I asked that I was allowed to see the baby and hold the baby for a few minutes. And so I was out and had the baby, and they wheeled me in there, and I did get to hold her. Her name is Jamie Lynn. I celebrate her birthday, which is July 18th, 1979. I do not know where she is. I have not heard from her. I put my name on the registry. If she is willing and God decides that that's the thing, she can find me. I changed my address so that she does know where I am today. I celebrate with my kids today. I have two kids, and we've always celebrated her birthday and her life. So after that, and I'm not going to say a whole lot after that, because after that, it became, I'm going to hurt you. You're not going to hurt me anymore. And I became the meanest, ugliest, use you, abuse you, do whatever I could do to you, and you weren't going to do it to me. And that's what I did for the next however many years that is, from 1979 until 1998. And by that I mean I have been married 5 times. I ran through people's lives. I needed somebody to depend on because I had no money, I had no skills, I had no social skills, I had anxiety, I had panic attacks, and I knew not how to live life. I knew how not to talk to anybody. My head was like this. I could not look at you, I could not hold my head up. I felt like the scum on the bottom of your shoe, but I was going to hurt you before you hurt me. And I would get married and not know how that happened until the next day. Apparently, I always said yes. And I would, it was like, not just once, okay, 4 times during my drinking. And I've been married since 2002 up till today in a recovery marriage. But that's what I did. In that time, I had 2 kids. I do have, and I got permission to say this, I have a son who is 31 years old. He has been on heroin since he was 15 years old. He is still actively using. And he is now, and he just now had, his girlfriend had a baby, and he's just now in and out and trying to do the next right thing, but refuses meetings or anything like that, so he knows what happens there. I have a daughter who has 3 beautiful children that I watch on a daily basis, and the little girl's 3 years old, and her name is Riley Kate, and she keeps me alive, and she keeps me living the dream of my childhood that I grieved. You know, we play, we run, we do a lot of things together. I walked into the rooms Alcoholics Anonymous, like I said, when I was 40 years old. I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew my life was unmanageable because between there and there, there are so many things. I would marry alcoholics. furniture would be missing. I had a gun held to my head. We played Russian roulette with it. That's the kind of relationships I was in. One killed my guinea pig. I say that because that was one thing that was so close to me. But the danger that I put myself in didn't matter because I drank and I drank and I drank. And I picked men who drank and drank just like me. And so I knew my life was unmanageable. You know, I knew that I had a problem. I always thought that I had a problem mentally. And that kept me for a long time staying out of help for alcoholism. What I mean by that is I would get drunk, really, really drunk, and then I'd go into that morbid reflection, and I would take myself and check myself into the psychiatrist, and then I would say I wanted to kill myself, and then I would go for relaxation at a mental health institution, and I would stay there, and I felt safe, and then this happened. The fact that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week ago or a month ago. We are without defense against that first drink. I'd go in there and I would get well, and I'd just say, it's just my mental state, you know. And after, like, I'd be there sometimes a month, and after that, I was okay. And I said, I could do this. And I'd leave there, but I never not picked up a drink again. And that went on and on and on for a long time. But there were some things that happened when I was 40 years old, and like one of them hiding in the bottom of my closet, like behind all the clothes so no one could see me just drinking myself to death. And my daughter is pretty much saved my life. She was only 11 years old, but I remember her coming and saying, "Mommy, can you please get out of the closet, and can you please get some help?" Now, mind you, I was a hospice. I took care of people that were dying, and I knew about alcoholism, and I knew about AA, and I remember just crawling to the phone, and I picked the phone up, and I asked for some help, and they told me there was a meeting not far from my house at that time. And I didn't think that I could drive because I had so many panic attacks, and I was paranoid of everything and everyone. And I remember getting in my car, and the Gwinnett room was only like maybe 10 minutes from the house I was living in. And it took me like 30 minutes to get there because I'd have to pull over and just pray that I would get there safely or I wouldn't kill anybody because I couldn't breathe, you know. And I started thinking about, if I go to AA, I'm going to have to stop drinking. I can't stop drinking because I don't know how to live life. And I don't know how to live life with it or without it. I said that before I ever came in and read that in this book. God-inspired book. So I knew about step one and two. Because I had already at one point taken two. But by the time I got there at 40, I was pretty insane. I didn't realize the insanity that you're talking about is the insanity that comes from me taking a drink and what happens to me when I take a drink. I at first thought that it meant mentally again. I was always focused on my mental state. I don't know if that was because I was always told that I'm just baggage, or that I was nothing, or I wasn't meant to be heard, I was just meant to be seen. And I always focused on the mental. And when I saw that, I thought, they'll never take care of that mental. But then I realized that, you know, later on I learned that alcohol is just a symptom. And I learned that the insanity is when I put that drink, what happens to me when I do that. And I become totally insane and totally incapable of not taking that first drink. And when I stopped drinking, I had the disease of the body, which means I had the disease of the obsession to find it, to have it, to feel it, to know it's going to take away the tension and the fear and the anxiety. That's the part that can still get me, even after 20 years, if I allow it. I have to be real careful sometimes, because that's the ism of the alcoholism. And step three was very, very difficult for me, only because I have a very rebellious independence. I just thought that I'm a survivor. I've made it through life. I've walked it out. I'm here. I didn't die. No one died. And I just rebelled against God, because what started happening is any relationship that I had with God at the time in that car, it went away every time I put the drink in, and I had no relationship. So I kind of lost God altogether. And then they talk about God and turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. And exactly what it says in the 12 and 12, it says, third step, what's going to happen to me if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God? And it says, I will become a non-entity. And what non-entity means is insignificant. And I went right back. I've never been significant to anyone. And I somehow, in my sick mind, began to put that on God. And so I didn't want a relationship with God. And it took about 5 years into the program. I worked some of the steps. I got to the point where I started to believe in my own God. And I went to a four step, got some of this garbage out to the best of my ability at the beginning, because it has taken many, many, many four steps for me to get to a point where I'm beginning to learn that I have PTSD, I have a lot of things going on in my life that I can get help for. I had to realize that it says in this book we can get outside help. I've had to do that, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful today, because I do not want to live my life without alcohol and not be happy, joyous, and free. And it says on page 133 in the big book, it says, God didn't do this. I create my own misery. Allow God to show His power. I'm not wording it exactly like it is, but it tells me I create my own misery within my head. And I can live in that and get self-pity and all those defects that they talk about in six. Step five was the beginning of a relationship with me, with a woman that I had never had a relationship with before. You know, I've never gotten intimate with anyone like that. And there's this woman who does a circuit speaker, and she says, intimate, into me see, intimate. And that's all I was asked to do in step five, was to allow somebody to get into me, to see the real me, and pray and hope that they would not walk away and not love me. I did not ever find that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the family that I always wished for. It's the family that I prayed to God for, stands in front of me every day that I attend a meeting. And it's the most unconditional love that I've ever felt in my life. And for me, that is truly, truly a miracle that happens in these rooms, if I'm willing. How? Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And that's all it takes. And it's hard, but it happened. And all those times that I begged with God, He gave me my dream, my family. And I had a dear friend say to me on the way here, he said, you know, I said I was a little nervous. You know, I get nervous speaking. And he said, it's okay. Just remember, you're in front of your family. And that's all I can ask for. Because no one's ever kicked me out of Alcoholics Anonymous for having feelings. I just want to read one thing and then I'll close. Because this is exactly what I feel. I try to find things. There's nothing in this big book that I can't relate to. But I really try to find things in here that speak the language of the heart. Because there's so many things that speak from the language of the heart. Each time we have a meeting, God's there. He speaks from me to you, you to me. It comes from the heart. And this comes from the big book. It's in one of the stories. And it's the keys to the kingdom. And it says, the last 15 years of my life, I have been rich and meaningful. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But also, I have known a great deal of joy and peace that is the handmaiden of the inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with many AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First, though, mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together during our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligations, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness, with the awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. Thank you.
Thank you. I could relate so much to your story. I really enjoyed it. I haven't asked nobody, but I'm going to volunteer Tinsley to pass out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Anybody want to pick up a white chip? 30 days, a silver chip. Gold chip for 60 days. How about a red chip for 3 months, 90 days? Yellow chip for 6 months. A green chip for 9 months. Anybody having a birthday, 1 year or multiples? All right, Brian. Come on down.
My name is Brian. I'm Paula Silver Alcohol.
Hey, Brian.
I wanted to say after you told your story, we're going to understand the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. Thank you for sharing. I've been here a little bit longer, but sometimes I don't think I've grown up enough. I do have glimpses of peace. The understanding of the word serenity is a tall order. Keep coming back. This is for 34 years. Clean.
All right, any other birthdays? Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Big hand for the chips you hold.
Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting tonight.
First I slip, and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real.
sometimes quickly, sometimes slow. We get just what we need on a broad highway, stride for stride. We walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. For something that set me free, and I'd arrive to a world in harmony. See love as a vision that one day would appear. Take me where the promise is.